Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this. Teresa Bourgeois is open for business. The computer is on. You're ready to go. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. It's Thursday. It's the 8th of March, and it's very nice to have you with us. It's International Women's Day.
Hey.
Good morning, and thank you. Happy International Women's Day, March 8th. And this is, of course, Women's History Month, but it's also International Women's Day. A lot of things going on. That's pretty much 99% of our content today as far as the latter half of the program. So we'll be talking a lot about that. And Alan and I also have three incredible women who are on our panel this morning. So we're thrilled about that as well. Let me introduce them. Teresa Bourgeois is here. You heard her computer, but now you can hear her own voice.
Good morning.
Communications consultant to the stars. How are you?
I'm just fantastic. Was out shoveling around 1 o'clock this morning to make sure I could get here.
None of that sounds fun.
Beautiful, beautiful, but so sad for my lilacs. They're taking a beating.
The lilacs are taking a beating?
Yeah, trees in general, lilacs in particular. But for people who have power, they don't care about my lilacs. Who don't have power, I mean.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, cheers to the people who went out and plowed.
Well, look who is here. Judy Patrick is with us. She, of course, is the editor, for the time being, of the Daily Gazette, and it's thrilling to have you. When is your last day?
March 30th, and I'm starting to get a little feisty in my later days. I will note that there are 365 days in a year, and we're getting one day
for
International Women's Day.
Oh, damn right. You should be feisty.
I am. I'm feisty.
Yeah,
now.
No, there's no problem with that. All right, good. I like it. And Vera Carias-Kelly is here. She is a professor of comparative politics at Siena College, and, she has the inside scoop on pretty much everybody in this region, and we're thrilled to have you with us this morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good to have you here, as always. And if I shut my eyes, I believe Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir.
That's right. Snowed in here in the beautiful Berkshires, but on our very complicated machine, which allows me to speak to you as if I'm there.
And who knows how that works, but all we do know, but we know that it does work, and so that's all that we really care about.
Yes, and I want to say one thing about Judy Patrick that I think is important. I've seen her at her most feisty, when she can really let you have it when she thinks you've done something wrong, even when you haven't.
We don't want to go there.
Couldn't just leave it there halfway.
Happy International Women's Day to you too, Alan.
Well, it started off very nicely, didn't it? All right, everybody, let's go to the what's happening in our world. I'm in a blatant ripoff from John Berman on CNN this morning. The White House is juggling tariffs and porn stars, as the framers of the Constitution had intended. Good God. All right, so let's begin with the tariff plan. And this is now, so the president comes out last week, comes out with this tariff plan. It tanks the stock market for that moment, does not do well. Republicans don't like it. Most people don't like it. And then Gary Cohn, who is his top economic advisor, he quits over it. Supposedly says, okay, I didn't want you to do this. You did this. I'm out. And Paul Ryan and other Republicans who have been mum on pretty much everything are now speaking up about this issue. Because as I believe, did you say it yesterday that aluminum is much more important than racism? Was that you that said
right,
that
yeah,
yesterday?
Yeah.
So
get some steel in their spine, as Nancy Pelosi said.
Good Lord. So there is that. Now, more than 100 Republican lawmakers have implored the president to drop plans for stiff and sweeping steel and aluminum tariffs as the White House prepared to formalize those measures today. Officials said late Wednesday that the plan would initially exempt Canada and Mexico and could ultimately exclude other allies. So does that mean that he's stepping back on this, or does that mean, what does that mean?
Well, let me just start by saying, and very briefly, that there was no question that Mexico and Canada were not to be excused. after the pushback came from his colleagues or from the other Republicans in the House and Senate, that's when he said there'll be a carve out for them. So that's already a step backwards.
Yeah, the fear of unintended consequences is what most of the Republicans are talking about now, especially, besides Cohn, Ryan, of course, is very concerned. McConnell is concerned. Right now they're talking about special arrangements for Mexico and Canada because Kushner is in Mexico talking to the Mexican president. And most of all, the European Union allies are concerned. And they're looking for special arrangements because if they are hit with those full tariffs, I think we will see a hard pushback and we will see an increasing potential for a more global trade war.
You are shaking your head, Teresa Bourgeois.
Yeah, I don't know that the president agreed yet on the protections for. I mean, what he said yesterday was that if they could negotiate it in the NAFTA negotiations, which remember we are pretty mm-hmm. much sidelined on the NAFTA negotiations yep. because of his views there. So I think they were talking about there was going to be a signing late this afternoon, and then late last night they said, well, there wasn't going to be a signing. I mean, what you really have is chaos. And as was noted by the experts, you heard it on NPR and other places this morning. In theory, this is really to target China because they're dumping aluminum and steel. But because we already have protections against Chinese steel, it's really not going to affect them. And it may, in fact, help them and hurt our closest allies, including the European allies. Stepping back, I mean, the problem, as Cohen talked about, is this is a real process problem. This is what happens when you don't bring together your economic advisors and talk through a plan and work through the details and work it out amongst your allies and then come up with a final solution. So who knows what's going to happen.
Teresa, don't you think that the carve-out for Mexico and Canada will come because the NAFTA negotiations will take months? And so if Trump signs something today, it will have the carve out for those two countries in it, because you can't put pressure on Mexico and Canada by simply signing these, tariffs to affect those two countries and then go back and renegotiate NAFTA.
Well, I don't know what will happen today, but whatever happens, there's going to be litigation. There's the it will probably violate existing treaties. So in terms of what he signs today is not necessarily what's going to be implemented. It's going to be what is discussed. And there'll be retaliation almost immediately. Yes. The Europeans, he attacked the Europeans on Twitter yesterday, our allies. He seems to attack our allies quite a bit. I'm not getting my mind around why he does that. The other group this will hurt is South Korea. So in the midst of these very delicate negotiations between North and, with us, North, South Korea, he's hurting South Korea. It's hard to say what the outcome will be if, in fact, part of this was a political move because of a congressional race in Pennsylvania. As many people speculate that that's one thing that got his attention, that this might help the folks in Pennsylvania. Well, reporters have gone in and found that it's going to hurt as many businesses in this district
exactly
as it's
right.
going to help. Yep. And so it's just chaos.
And one of the issues is, what will it undermine the World Trade Organization? Will they accept the rationale for this tariff being that we need it for national security? And if they don't accept it, and we go ahead with it anyways, what happens to the World Trade Organization? Is this the end of their governance of how we conduct trade in the world?
I mean, it's fascinating to think about that, because the WTO was in essence pushed by the United States as a global regime to manage trade. And now it might be the Trump administration dismantling the WTO if it single-handedly withdraws, which, is sort of similar to the Paris agreements. Those are the kinds of questions that now emerge.
Alan, this is something that I'm curious about, because I know most of these rules and logical thinking doesn't apply with this particular president or administration, but is this win worth what he's going through?
Well, it depends what you're looking at. If you're looking at the politics of the situation, he thinks it is. If you're looking at the substance, as Teresa has brilliantly laid out for us, it isn't. But if you're looking at what he thinks is his brand of chaotic presidency, playing to the base, playing to the electorate in Pennsylvania, and we get criticized every once in a while for talking too much politics. But politics and policy are pretty well married, don't you think?
Totally.
Well, yeah,
intertwined.
That's sort of what we do,
sure,
on the show.
Except,
yeah.
Alan, don't you think that he's trying to play to his base, but he's really missing the mark? Because he seems to be playing to his steelworker base, but then he's forgetting his other, his other base. Because,
I was thinking about that. But you have to remember that some groups are more energized, more political, more focused than others are. So that when Teresa says, well, you know, they went in and they found out that it would hurt more than it would help, the question is, how diffuse are the others compared to the steelworkers?
Well, I don't think that's actually, the steelworkers might be really outspoken at the moment, but you already hear other sectors speak up. And I, just listening in on the radio this morning, driving over here, I heard a bunch of interviews with people working in other industries down the supply chain, very concerned about factories closing and people losing their jobs. So I think the mood overall is not positive about these tariffs. There are a lot of concerns among his potential base. So I would expect Trump to actually reverse his position this afternoon to an extent.
Well, I think he's going to reverse it too, but not for the reasons you do, because it makes substantive sense. I think the reason he's going to do it is because he's in real trouble with the people in the Congress who are really furious at him, but not furious enough, as I said yesterday, when Paul Ryan, who really is spineless in all of this, steps into it. He doesn't do it personally, which he does in so many other cases. He sends out, a staffer to say, that the speaker isn't in favor of this. They're all afraid of getting primaried. Everybody worries about that. And they know that he's so popular with the Republican base that he could be the death knell for them.
But by all accounts, members of the Freedom Caucus and Congressman Brady and others, the budget chairman, were up over to the White House yesterday trying to explain to him the problems here. But in regard to the steelworkers, it's interesting to me that the U.S. and Canadian steelworkers are intertwined in the same union. And they understand, as was reported today in the paper and other places, they understand that the, as you talked about, Vera, the supply chains are intertwined between the U.S. and Canada.
Yes.
And so that's, when you're talking about impact on the economy, because the two economies as well as Mexico are so intertwined, it will have probably more negative effect than positive. But let's step back for a second. I mean, there is an argument that can be made that the U.S., for national security reasons, should retain some of its capacity to produce steel because it's so fundamental to our economy. So there's an argument for that, but it's got to be done in the right way. And by all accounts from the experts, this is not the right way.
Accordingly, from what I understand, 2/3 of the steel we consume, we produce. So we produce a fair amount already. My big thing is, why is this the issue the Republicans have finally, this is the line in the sand that the Republicans say, nope, we're not going to go. Why everything else? Why they look the other way?
It wasn't immigration. It wasn't racism. It wasn't just erratic behavior.
Campaign contributions from big corporations. What drives this?
Harley-Davidson is in Ryan's district.
In Wisconsin. And the bourbon.
And the bourbon is in
Kentucky.
And the orange juice.
And then Iowa is Caterpillar that depends on steel. And these guys want to, a bunch of these people want to run for president. And the Europeans are very shrewd, and immediately they said, here's how we're going to retaliate. We're going to retaliate with, Florida, orange juice, cranberries. We're going to retaliate where we know it's going to hurt these folks.
That's right. They're going right for the states where they know some of the Republican influential voices are. And right now, McConnell and Ryan are talking to Trump, trying to redirect him.
And
if
you have car part suppliers in your state or in your district, this is a big problem for you. And so, and And it doesn't really go after the so-called, you know, as the union folks are talking about today, the cheaters. You know, China is dumping. It doesn't really affect China. It will only help China.
Because the Chinese will begin selling more throughout Asia. I mean, that is the market they're developing in the first place. They already have, as you mentioned, Teresa, tariffs on their steel in the United States. So this is the wrong path. It should have been negotiated. There should have been a pushback throughout the entire period against China. This, to me, looks more like a redirect, a political redirect away from Russia.
Right.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We'll have letters, and we'll also move on to other topics as well. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Judy Patrick, and Teresa Bourgeois join us this morning. We'll be right back with more program right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Judy Patrick, and Teresa Bourgeois, all on our program this morning. We've been talking about tariffs. We've been talking about the possibility of trade wars. And just before we move on to some other subjects, so let us talk about what we think could happen, may happen today as the EU pledges to fight back on the tariffs. What do you think the end result would or could be?
Well, I mean, I suspect that some kind of announcement will come today where Trump grandiosely signs something, and then it will show that there are numerous carve-outs for European allies, because that's the big push. I mean, everybody fears, except for people like Wilbur Ross. Everybody else fears in the Republican Party, such as Ryan and McConnell and you know, 100 other members of the party, that there will be direct negative consequences in their districts when the Europeans, should the Europeans engage in countermeasures and push back against potential tariffs. My expectation is that there are carve-outs coming to protect allies, because they really are not at the center of what the Trump administration wanted to do. They wanted to push back against China, and they need to figure out what policies they really want to implement to engage with China on ending steel and aluminum dumping rather than targeting their own allies.
You know what I've learned to do in this administration is just brace myself for anything. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm probably going to be completely surprised come 7 o'clock tonight.
Because you don't know what he's going to say.
I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I still hope that there's some rationality left. Sorry.
Maybe not.
Judy. Everybody's laughing at me. No, I'm okay with
guess. No, not laughing at you. Just the idea of there being rationality, that's all. Alan, what do you think?
Well, I think when you talk about rationality, which is a great word, you have to think in terms of getting inside of Donald Trump's mind. His rationality is, hey, I'm president of the United States. Hey, how did I get here? I played to a particular base. Hey, how do I stay here? I continue to do the same thing. And if it means that there's a big wide gap between the Teresa and Vera beautiful analysis of why this is a bad idea and my personal well-being as president of the United States and staying president of the United States, guess which one I'm going for?
I'm just hoping somebody got to him and told him, listen, buddy, your base is not just made up of steel workers. There are many, many others that will lose their jobs in the next year if you engage in a full-blown trade war. So watch out.
And does he want to retain the House come November?
You know, Vera and Judy, but Vera in particular on this one, you know, the sociology, I don't know how to say this because I really haven't been able to formulate this correctly, but the sociology of the American electorate is terribly important here. In other words, yes, there comes a point at which a group of people get together and accept a certain kind of logic. And they say, down with you, Trump, or up with you, Trump. I don't see that happening in this more diffuse space that you're referring to. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I don't see that electricity. I don't see the kind of coming together that you find with the steel industry, for example.
Teresa?
Yeah.
Or Vera?
I mean,
do you want to respond?
No, go ahead, Teresa.
Well, I was going to go. My thought about what is today is whatever he says at 3:30 today is not necessarily what's going to happen.
Right.
And that's become a pattern. And in fact, it tends to be a dangerous pattern because the words of the President of the United States typically matter. But what our allies and our adversaries and our Congress and the press and others have come to learn with this president is that he makes declarations of what he's going to do, but there isn't necessarily follow through. So I think we'll wait. We'll see what he says. We'll see what the impact is on the markets and on our friends and allies. But one of the things that interested me is obviously someone has gotten to him a bit to help him understand that he's looking to the past, not to the future, because one of the things he did tweet out about yesterday is he said the U.S. is acting swiftly on intellectual property theft. We can not allow this to happen as it has for years. Because, again, what the experts say is the issue isn't tariffs on steel and aluminum. The issue with China really is theft of intellectual property and how we're going to manage the industries of the future, which is artificial intelligence and these new innovations. And so that's really what they should be focusing on, and that which was one of Cohen's arguments. We'll see what happens, but whatever is said today, I don't think that's ultimately what's going to happen.
The intellectual property issue, though, is not very sexy in terms of the voting bloc. You know, Alan, you were talking about how is Trump going to talk to steel workers about intellectual property. They couldn't really, I don't know that people really care that much about that. They care about their jobs right now, and they want to have better pay and future opportunities. So that's a difficult way. That's a difficult idea
exactly.
to translate.
But think about him during the campaign, on and on, denigrating our folks who did trade deals. You know, we have the worst trade deals. We have terrible negotiators.
Yes.
We're the best negotiators.
Yeah.
Well, he is proving by his own actions that, in fact, he's setting us back, not forward.
No doubt.
With
I mean,
this.
We agree on that. He's a terrible negotiator. That we do know now.
All right. We have some letters, as Vera just said a moment ago. This may not be the sexiest topic, but it's generating a lot of mail.
Oh, good.
So let's go to those. Mike says, doesn't the tariff issue and all other issues that surrounds the president essentially come down to dealing with a 70-year-old man that has never had to worry about the consequences of his actions, living a life of impunity?
Well, I think
could be.
That's a good point. We can agree.
And, you know, I wonder about his issue on steel. Is that because he's a guy who builds buildings and it's been a problem for him in the past? You know, what is his thing about?
But
he's had this issue for years.
Yeah, but it could be outside. I mean, I think that letter was sort of profound in that we have talked about this so many times. He has changed the approach to norms. The norm of, okay, you know, you broke the law. You can't break the law. You owe somebody money. You have to pay them the money. You force somebody into bankruptcy if that's what happens because they don't have the money to operate with. I don't give a damn, he's saying. That's their problem. That's not my problem. I'll get lawyers. I'll hold them up. I'll do that. So what he has done as a businessman, he's doing as a president. Only there's a big difference between what happens on one level and the other, but he certainly is trying that.
We got this letter from Tom who says Republicans are historically the party of free trade. A tariff works against the free market. Some Republicans in Congress are now remembering something about their belief system that defines them as Republicans, which is why they are now speaking out against a tariff. Trump is the accidental Republican.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, he certainly doesn't stand for anything in terms of trade-related issues that the Republicans traditionally stood for. It's so correct.
Gina wants to know, won't steel and aluminum tariffs affect Boeing?
Yes.
Absolutely. All right. And we got this from Bob, who says the latest revised statements from Navarro speaking for the White House said that, quote, Canada and Mexico would be exempted for now. And as Bob asks or says, whatever that means. Well, that's it.
Well, we know what it means, all right. It means he's got to pull back. And they have to have a rationale for their pulling back. As I said earlier, there was no going to be no carve out for Mexico and Canada. Then there was this business of, well, we're going to be, it's going to be our NAFTA negotiation. And now he says for now, and I believe that means NAFTA, doesn't it, gang?
Yeah, negotiate as part of the NAFTA. He thinks it's leverage in negotiating the NAFTA agreements.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
You know, just like we were on the sidelines on TPP, I thought there was an interesting article in the New York Times about Jared Kushner being in Mexico, meeting with the Mexican president. And buried deep in that article was a little factoid that I didn't realize, but I think it's interesting that China has become the top trading partner with Peru, Chile, Brazil, and Argentina. Mm-hmm. So right here in our backyard, you know, amongst our friends.
Well, the Chinese have expanded wherever the United States has left a vacuum in terms of a political economic vacuum. The Chinese are all over the African continent. They already dominate in Asia, and now they're all over Latin America. I mean, this is not a surprise. It's been going like this for the past 20 years. Right. But now they're really marching because the United States are not... is not present, not through diplomatic means, not through economic means, and now also withdrawing politically as partners.
Interesting that Tillerson, Rex Tillerson's Secretary of State's first trip to any African country is this week right now.
Mm-hmm. Linda writes to us and says, does anybody think that Sarah Huckabee Sanders may be the next White House staffer to resign? It seems she made an error yesterday by revealing a secret restraining order. This is in regards to the Stormy Daniels situation. From what we know, President Trump's personal lawyer obtained a secret restraining order last week to block Stormy Daniels, the porn actress, from speaking publicly about Trump's alleged extramarital affair with her. And that is according to Daniels' attorney. And so there were two parts of what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said in the press briefing yesterday. And the first part was obviously she was reading. And then the second part certainly alluded to the fact that, yes, this they had worked on this agreement. So I don't know if she'll be the next person to go or not.
I don't think so.
But I
think she's done a terrific job for him. I'm not a fan of Sarah Huckabee Sanders. In fact, quite the opposite. But she doesn't equivocate. She just lies, just the same way he does.
And
and when you get somebody like that, you keep them.
There was an article this morning, I believe, in the Washington Post that was saying that he is fuming over what she said yesterday, and that a source in the White House said that this is very similar as to how the Sean Spicer story went, as far as, you know, you make a mistake and then eventually you pay for it with your job.
I don't believe it, not for a second. I think she's the best thing he's got going for him, and he knows it. He can fume when that information gets out, but I think she's as secure as anybody. You can mark down that I said that on this particular, Thursday.
All right. Now, as far as the issue of Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Joe, what's interesting this morning is it's not only the president's lawyer who paid the money, but it's now the lawyer's lawyer. who's involved in this and issuing the threats? And what I can't figure out about this whole thing is we all know the story. I mean, what is she shutting up about? She's already talked about it. She's been very specific, how they sat on the bed, how they did this, how they did that. What in the world are we asking her to shut up about?
But isn't the larger issue whether or not, as Common Cause maintains, this was a campaign contribution that was that should have been reported?
$130,000 that was paid out from the campaign to this woman.
And we got one letter saying, did she pay taxes on that?
Yeah, well, who knows? But I mean, the main question is that it was a story that was snuffed out. What was it, 11 days before the election? It could have potentially changed or shaped people's views. And the question is the campaign contribution, not about her relationship, I think, with President Trump.
Right. Well, could have, should have. But the fact of the matter is we know what happened. We do know what happened. Now, she says she thinks it's very important that the American people know what happened. But we do, because she already told us that. So I don't get, other than the fact that she is feathering her own nest here, that obviously the more present she is in the public discourse, the more likely it is that a book or public appearances or anything else will get her a fortune.
Unless she has something else to say that she hasn't said, or one of her friends hasn't already said.
I mean, she still has the. I mean, she still.
Good point.
The order. There is some indication she may have photos and
text messages
and various.
Yeah. Well, she hasn't violated the order yet, but the information has come out through these legal filings. Her lawyer has been very adept at putting content into the legal filings, and in her not answering questions, you know, by, in fact, when she went on Jimmy Kimmel, you know, by the fact that she didn't answer the question, provided the answer. But what's stunning to me is you think about yesterday, with all that was going on, the fact that a adult film star was paid money in advance of the election, and then last week the president's private lawyer, filed against her to try to keep her quiet, was not the biggest story of the day. You know, I think it was the third biggest story of the day. The Seychelles meeting, I think, is the biggest, and then the tariffs the second, and then her the third. How astounding is that in our government in our country right now, when this is, you know, not even the biggest story, but it raises a lot of questions.
And quite honestly, if it had come out before the election, I don't think it would have changed a pro-Trump supporter's mind.
I don't think so. Although, you know, the idea that unless the timing of it, in the sense that this is an affair that happened while just 2 weeks after his wife gave birth to their son, I don't know. It didn't work for John Edwards. Let's put it that way.
Well, and Bill Clinton, let's not forget him. It almost brought down his presidency. So these infidelities become more important, and as Teresa has always said, than the policy issues that are so incredible.
So many things that could have brought down any other mere mortal president that has not touched this guy.
But the payout question, though, to keep her silent, to say that it, so you have Sarah Huckabee Sanders and you have the president saying that this never happened, that she's lying, yet there was a payout before the election. Okay, so if she's lying, if it didn't happen, why are they then going to court last week to keep her silent? If it's not true, why are they working so hard to force her silence? And reportedly in the agreement that they signed, which David Dennison, you know, his false name, the president's false name, he didn't sign it. He was supposed to sign it. So
Is he the PR guy too?
Yeah, no, that's, no, that's John.
I don't remember.
What's his son's name?
I don't know.
Anyway, he had a different name when he was a fake PR guy. Apparently, in whatever got her the $130,000 she signed, there's $1 million fine for every time she discloses any information she has. And so they've gone to court to try to nullify that because there was a line for the president to sign this agreement, and he didn't sign it. Cohen signed it, but he didn't sign it.
Yep.
But if nothing happened, as the president said, then why?
What are you worried about?
Why pursue this?
Right?
And to Judy's point too, you know, would it matter even? And even to Alan's point, you know, we already know. Our minds can sort of fill in the blanks, right?
Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting, this whole conversation too, about his private lawyer supposedly having done this arrangement on his own without his clients.
Well, that would be illegal, by the way. You can't do that.
Right?
It's illegal because you can't represent somebody without presenting them the paperwork. So
the interesting thing to me is also, what position will his lawyer be in? Will he actually potentially take the fall for President Trump if it necessary? Because he had already, from what I understand, complained to some of his friends that the $130,000 he paid to Stormy Daniels was not paid back yet to him by the president. And so there were clearly some tensions about how informed is the president, and now will the president actually make
and as
his
I said
lawyer
before,
take the fall?
Right. And as I said before, the lawyer, the president's lawyer, has now had to get himself his own lawyer. So. Yeah. And so,
well, look, he's in deep. He's in
yeah,
pretty serious legal trouble. The FEC,
yeah.
But you know, the weakened FEC. Who's going to go after him? You know, also the when he made the $130,000 transfer, that triggered a bank notice, because anything over $10,000,
right.
That mm-hmm. triggers a bank notice. So you know, there are all sorts of ways that this could be pursued. But again, and in the meantime, I'll be the broken record here. In the meantime, the Republicans, you know, are they're taking away our health care when we're not paying attention, and so many other things are happening.
All right. We're very late for a break, so let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have some letters, and then we'll go to the top of the hour break. We'll do all of that right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we have a couple of letters, and then we have to take another break at the top of the hour. I got a little behind there, and so we're going to catch up, do a couple of letters, and then I want to move on to, as Teresa has deemed it, and I think you're right, is the big story of the day, which is the Seychelles meeting.
Seychelles.
So we'll talk about that coming up after our break. But first, Alan writes, when I talk to Trump supporters, they love what he's doing, citing America First anti-establishment nonsense, and cite a vastly improved economy, which I also know to be nonsense. What are your thoughts on this? Well, that's what we've been talking about, right? About the base, and everyone looks very sad.
But
right
you
now.
Know, but you know, Joe, the base isn't moving, and that is fascinating to me. With everything that we've learned about Trump and all his nonsense, you know, and all of the you know, all of the philandering and all of that, the base stays steady.
But they will be moving, Alan, on jobs. They will be moving if these tariffs come. It's going to hurt them in their pocket and their future job opportunities. This is going to really move the base, a section of the base, against them.
And I don't think the House...
Will is the operative word.
Yeah, well,
you know, it hasn't happened yet. That's all
will,
I got to say. And when you go
and
talk to the Vera, when you go and talk to the coal miners, right? Because remember,
yep.
You played the coal, and they're not moved.
I think some have. They're disappointed in not having gotten more help. I think they're already moving.
I have seen no evidence of it, and I have seen stories about that. And so, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it hasn't happened. And there are a lot of people who think that if he stays with this plan, he will win again with the same group of people because of the Electoral College and the way that it's going. I'm disappointed, but you gotta at least see that group is not moving.
No, I disagree. I think that he's getting some erosion in that base. People I talk to who have always been pro-Trump, it wears on them after a while. The tweets, and once we'll see what the tax bill will actually do to them, and we'll see what this if the price of the washing machine they're going to buy goes up. I think time will tell. There's a lot of time between the next presidential election.
Well, as a political scientist, let me just say, I don't see the evidence. But as a human being and as your friend, I couldn't agree more with you. I hope it happens, but I just haven't seen it yet.
I think the evidence is more than 100 members of Congress signing a letter against him and Ryan finally and McConnell going after him, because if they believe that, you know, they've been afraid of his base, and obviously they're not afraid on this issue, so... That's the evidence.
Travis writes, is it possible the business community will find Democrats a safer bet for preserving free trade norms, at least in the near future?
Isn't that actually ironic? But yes.
And then Susan says, since the 90s, it seems as though most Americans have adopted a more European view of infidelity for our quote-unquote leaders.
I think there's a special arrangement for somebody like Trump, because everybody knew who voted for him, that he comes with that kind of environment. You know, even I mean, I still am stumped by the notion of, you know, evangelicals forgiving him.
Well, I've never understood that.
I never understood that, I guess.
I
just
that.
Was like, either principled or you're not, but the sort of special arrangement for President Trump seems rather bizarre to me.
I think his anti-abortion stance is what drives that evangelical support. But this whole attitude about what we expect from our leaders in terms of being moral standing. I mean, when they campaign, they always bring out the family. And, you know, I'm a family values. And then once they get elected, we're starting to look the other way a lot.
I mean, people aren't perfect. Nobody's perfect, but this strains credulity and breaks laws. I mean, that's the difference between personal behavior and law breaking, and this breaks laws. You know, there's some things that are between him and his wife, and other things are him and the courts.
Well, the one thing that sells more on the internet than anything else is pornography. We know that, and we know how many people bought Playboy and other magazines before it was all easily available on TV and other places. So could it be said that we now have the first pornographer president?
I don't know if we can say that.
I don't know.
Yeah,
about
I don't
that,
know.
But...
What political scientist related data are you using here, Alan?
I mean, intuition.
It just sets them up to be.
Somebody's got to put it out there.
It sets them up to be, you know. For anyway, bribed, whatever.
Bribed, whatever. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll get to the big story of the day. We also have Ray Graff standing by with news.
Shaking his head.
We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is the Thursday. Let's try that again. It is the 8th of March. It is a Thursday. And good morning and welcome to the program. Alan Chartok is here. Vera Akarios-Kelly from Siena College is with us. We also have the Daily Gazette's Judy Patrick and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois. Let us go to the story that we've been sort of dancing around a little bit. In the last hour or so, and that is and we talked about this yesterday as well, of course, but Mueller is gathering evidence that the 2017 Seychelles meeting was an effort to establish a back channel to the Kremlin. This is what we sort of know. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has gathered evidence that a secret meeting in Seychelles just before the inauguration of Donald Trump was an effort to establish a back channel between the incoming administration and the Kremlin, apparently contradicting statements made to lawmakers by one of its participants, according to people familiar with the matter. In January of 2017, Eric Prince, the founder of the private security company Blackwater, met with a Russian official close to Russian President Vladimir Putin and later described the meeting to congressional investigators as a chance encounter that was not a planned discussion of U.S.-Russia relations. Wasn't he lucky? A witness cooperating with Mueller has told investigators the meeting was set up in advance so that a representative of the Trump transition could meet with an emissary from Moscow to discuss future relations between the countries, according to the people familiar with the matter. They, of course, spoke on the condition of anonymity. George Nader, a Lebanese-American businessman who helped organize and attend the Seychelles meeting, has testified on the matter before a grand jury gathering evidence about the discussions between the Trump transition team and emissaries of the Kremlin as part of Mueller's investigation into the Russian efforts to interfere with the 2016 election. Nader began cooperating with Mueller after he arrived at Dulles International Airport in mid-January and was stopped, served with a subpoena, and questioned by the FBI. That, according to the people that were quoted earlier, he has met numerous times with investigators. All of this, according to the Washington Post. Who would like to go first?
Well, Judy, Teresa, and I were joking earlier that it seems so convincing that you have a chance encounter in the Seychelles because it's, you know, where we all just randomly fly to and spend some time. And then there is this encounter with a Russian and then with Eric Prince and members of the UAE. And it all sounds hardly like a chance encounter. It sounds like a very well orchestrated and planned gathering to exchange information and to make arrangements in a place where it was thought you would not be discovered, far away from maybe intelligence services where the observations would fly under the radar or where you wouldn't be observed and wouldn't be recorded.
Also part of an S-hole country too, right?
I guess.
just Just saying.
You know, when this story broke in the December before the inauguration, there was, you know, talk that the Trump administration was attempting to establish this back channel. And the defense was, well, what's wrong with that? We just want to communicate. We want to. And but then over time, there were the denials that this was happening. And there are reasons why you don't want an administration to have a back channel with Russia. And it seemed like early on they didn't understand that. And that's why they were so defensive. Now, when we have very clear testimony before the grand jury, one of the issues is, has anyone else from the Trump administration gone to the grand jury and said otherwise?
And I think there's a very good, there's some pretty good evidence that that is exactly what Mueller is looking at. The Blackwater founder, the secret meeting, and that he has stuff on that. Of course, that's one more example of what we don't know that he has.
The whole idea, though, about back channels, I mean, what's wrong with just going through the normal channels? I mean, I don't even understand the logic in this.
It's so arrogant to think that you, as a businessman, can go and gather somewhere, or like Jared Kushner going somewhere without, you know, in Mexico, without integrating the American ambassador to Mexico. Why would you not take advantage of the resources that have existed in the State Department, prepare for your meetings, get information and reports that tell you more about the agendas that are pursued by a particular administration in each of the countries that you have a gathering at. Then you are prepared, and then afterwards you normally debrief. The question about Jared Kushner was also, why does he have these back-channel private meetings without preparation and without debriefing afterwards? Are these people all doing private business on behalf, pretending to be speaking on behalf of the American people when in fact they're enriching themselves? That's what it looks like.
And this was a meeting with, as Alan mentioned, the Blackwater founder Eric Prince, who is the brother of the Betsy DeVos, the education secretary. And as people may recall, Blackwater, there have been issues about them in the past. They were under investigation. Face scrutiny during the President George Bush's administration. And the question is, did Eric Prince lie to the investigators about this meeting, the purpose of this meeting? And if it was not for a nefarious reason, why would they lie about it? And I do think that, you know, 6 months from now, when we look back, I think we'll find that this is a very important piece of the puzzle that we don't know all the details yet, but a very important piece of the puzzle. And oddly enough, it was reported today that Eric Prince is hosting a fundraiser for Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. And he, who is one of the closest people on the Russia issue, he's been defending it in odd ways. And among those scheduled to attend are Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North.
Oh, so, Lord, help us all.
I thought that was it's a side issue, that's but great. I just thought that it was. I also heard on the news last night that the president, Trump, went to dinner last night, a private fundraising dinner at the home of Seaboard and Gray, a former attorney who helped out on a number of these when previous White Houses had gotten into trouble. So, you know a person by the company they keep.
Yes, indeed. I mean, Eric Prince, to me, is just simply a criminal. He was involved in using and building up mercenary armies. He was involved. His organization, his company, Blackwater, was the one that was, you know, using mercenaries in Iraq, had the shootout at Nisour Square when innocent Iraqi civilians were gunned down. And four, I think, of the contractors that worked for Blackwater got lengthy prison sentences. And he actually, Eric Prince, had to leave the country for quite some time. Then he went to the UAE and built up a mercenary force there. This is the kind of man that I think you always want to keep an eye on, because he's always interested in enriching himself, and he lacks any kind of commitment to human rights, social justice, or even following basic standards of our laws.
And so there's
so much has changed from the beginning. remember that Donald Trump was pushing Russia. I love the Russians. I hope the Russians release the Hillary stuff. I know Putin. He's a good man. All of those things were ginned up based on the relationship that the American – what the perception of the American people felt about Russia. Now, that has changed substantially, I think, from the beginning until now. I think now there's the acceptance of the idea that the Russians are, in their own language, no goodniks. And therefore, it has changed the way in which the Trump people and almost everybody else are approaching all of this.
You know, it's interesting that this meeting, Russian bankers, Emirati officials, and then this George Nader, Middle East specialist, ties to the Emirati leaders. What could be the purpose? And you have no idea if it's interlinked, but you think of the U.S.'s position against Qatar when the Saudis and the UAE went after Qatar. Now, Qatar's been key to us in that region because our bases were in Qatar. And everyone was kind of scratching their heads thinking, why is the U.S. taking this position on Qatar?
Against its own national security and military interests.
And then you don't know, but then you have to wonder. Now, when you see that this January 2017 back-channel meeting happened, then it gives you pause to wonder on what basis are decisions being made. And, you know, I hate to just put that out there because you don't know what the facts are, but when this kind of thing happens, then it raises all kinds of questions that you shouldn't have to be dealing with. You shouldn't have to wonder. But with Nader now cooperating with Mueller, you know, could that be why Trump was so nervous last week? Mm-hmm. Because clearly he was very nervous last week.
So what are you really saying here? Are you saying that you think that, they pose it as a question, are you saying you think that the Russians may have so much on Trump because of the business dealings and the rest of it, that Trump has to break with his own people who consistently say the Russians are a threat, the Russians are a problem, and the Russians are doing this, and he's saying, no, I don't believe it, I don't think they were. So what does that lead us to conclude, except that maybe the Russians have some compromising information on Trump?
The thing is, we don't know. But we're in this horrible position of having to wonder. I mean, that's the problem with all of this. That is, and because all the norms are sort of out the window, and because you don't have, you know, you have a situation where Senator McConnell, just in advance of the campaign, presented with basic factual information. Again, I'll talk about the Jane Mayer article in the New Yorker. If you haven't read it, go read it, about the Steele dossier. You know, he violated a basic norm where politics ends at the shoreline, and that you govern, and that they should have all come together as Democrats and Republicans and said no to this Russian thing. But all of these basic norms are sort of gone out the window in the last 2 years. It's really troubling.
Follow the money is what I say. That's how we will get our answers.
You know, think about where's the first place that Trump went, right? He went to Saudi Arabia. Am I right? Remembering that was his first international trip. You know, typically the first international trip is to either Canada, Mexico, or Great Britain. And his first international trip was to Saudi Arabia.
But the receptions were much better there.
Yeah, there was a lot of gold, a lot of parading.
Announcing big military deals. Did they come through? I don't know. No, because of the sovereign wealth fund issues that got in the way. I think we're going to hear a lot more about the Seychelles over time.
Going to bring up the name of Robert Mueller again. The special counsel in the Russia investigation has learned of two conversations in recent months in which President Trump asked key witnesses about matters they discussed with investigators, according to three people familiar with the encounters. In one episode, the president told an aide that the White House counsel, Donald McGahn, should issue a statement denying a New York Times article in January. The article said that Mr. McGahn told investigators that the president once asked him to fire the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Mr. McGahn never released a statement and later had to remind the president that he had indeed asked Mr. McGahn to see that Mr. Mueller was dismissed. In the other episode, Mr. Trump asked his former chief of staff, Reince Priebus, how the interview had gone with the special counsel's investigators and whether they had been nice, according to two people familiar with the discussion. The episodes demonstrate that even as the special counsel appears to be intensifying, the president has ignored his lawyer's advice to avoid doing anything publicly or privately that could create the appearance of interfering with it. But the question is that even experts looking at this say it's probably not tampering, which I guess means that I don't really understand what tampering is.
Well, the other issue is he fishing to know what they said? So if he talks to the grand jury, he doesn't contradict it.
It's consistent, yeah.
Right, so you don't want to gin up your story with everyone else. Or that's what, I mean, yeah, people are saying it's not tampering. He's saying, were they nice? I think that's just fishing for information from previous. And it's not like he's just passing the time of day. Again, you have to wonder if Trump is trying to make sure he doesn't lie or get caught in a lie, which is very serious.
Well, with McGahn, isn't one of the issues that he's trying to get McGahn to say, that he didn't do what McGahn
did. Yeah, well,
he's
trying to have McGahn lie for him, right?
Right. But the interesting, one of the interesting things about this, you know, palace intrigue is, where's this leak from? Mm. And a number of people speculate that, in fact, it's from McGahn and just trying to get the word out there that, you know, he hasn't violated the law, that try to keep his reputation such as it is. But
there are limits.
He's an interesting character. Yeah.
There are limits for guys like McGahn because, you know, he's the president's lawyer, all right, but he doesn't want to get caught up in the kind of situation where he could get disbarred for lying.
Yeah, this article goes on to say that Mr. Trump's interactions with Mr. McGahn unfolded in the days after the January 25th Times article, which said that McGahn threatened to quit last June after the president asked him to fire the special counsel. After the article was published, the White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter told Mr. McGahn that the president wanted him to release a statement saying that the story was not true. Mr. Porter, who resigned last month, which was only February, by the way, amid a domestic abuse scandal, told Mr. McGahn that the president had suggested he might get rid of Mr. McGahn if he chose not to challenge the article, the people briefed on the conversation said. So there you are. So
former FEC commissioner, Federal Elections Commission commissioner, Don McGahn. Quite controversial when he was there, quite controversial as the White House counsel.
That's his expertise, to be controversial with our controversial president.
he's no John Dean, right?
Well,
it all yet to be determined.
It's also said here that it's not clear how the confrontation was resolved. Mr. McGahn has stayed on as White House counsel, one of the few senior administration officials who had been with the president since the campaign. So,
You know, I thought it was nice to know that he said, "No, I'm not going to call the newspaper and lie." I thought that I was reassured by that.
I think that's what he wanted you to think nicely of him.
I do.
So his mission is accomplished.
Warm, yeah.
But again, we're setting the bar pretty low, aren't we? All right. We are just about out of time. I want to thank everybody who checked in with us. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Judy Patrick, and Teresa Bourgeois. I thank you all very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Be well. We'll continue our program after this short break.